Hi, and welcome back to another interview here at Sitel. Today we'll feature Ursula Gozarek. And Ursula, I'd like to welcome you to our conversation. We'll be speaking about rare disease development, specifically innovations in trial designs and implementations that can yield a greater degree of success in the rare disease area. Ursula, how are you?
Hello, Mike. Nice to meet you here via phone and talk about rare diseases.
Yes, and Ursula, of course, you're with the Statistical Consulting Group here at Sitel, and you have a range of experiences in helping sponsors to achieve better trial designs that can improve their clinical research results. So, Ursula, maybe you might want to talk just a little bit about your background and how you work in the Statistical Consulting Group here at Sitel.
Well, actually, I have been doing a lot of different things for a statistician. I started actually in the interplay between statistics and machine learning, doing my PhD in complexity reduction in high-dimensional data spaces, and continuing from my first job at Roche Diagnostics, being in the biomarker discovery field, doing metabolomics, proteomics, and then also biomarker assay development. And then I went to Unilever, and there I was in the beginning clinical trials in food, skin, oral. So being responsible for a wide variety of clinical trials, not in really the pharma field, but actually in a fast-moving consumer goods study. Environment.
Would that be more in the nutrition side? The nutrition side,
It's more in the personal care domain that they do clinical trials, but the more pharma-like clinical trials are obviously in the foods domain, when you really want to have a claim on some health benefit from a food product.
So you have a right, wide range of experience when it comes to the various therapeutic areas, including skin. And sometimes we forget that the human skin is the largest organ of the human body.
Yes, and people suffer a lot if the skin is not in a healthy condition.
Of course. And so, from Unilever, how did you move on from there?
Well, this continued smoothly when I moved to Sitel, and then starting to support sponsors from different size pharma companies, but for the rare diseases, for me, it was mostly quite small companies that had a very interesting molecule or therapy which they wanted to provide evidence that they actually help in a rare disease. So within Sitel, I have meanwhile several projects where I supported people in their clinical development for rare diseases.
And what have you learned from that experience with the rare disease development from the developers? How would you characterize them?
Well, I think the very good part of rare disease development is that actually the regulatory bodies are very supportive. So there is an interest both from the FDA and from the EMA to get good new products fast on the market for rare diseases. So in the interaction with the authorities, I found to be very pleasant because very supportive. So especially with the EMA in the European area, because I'm based in Europe, so I predominantly have contact with the EMA. So this positive attitude towards the rare disease development, I find a very nice area to work, because innovative trial designs are not only frowned upon, but actually you get support in trying out new things in case this really helps bring in a new product faster to the market.
So, Ursula, it's safe to say that the regulatory agencies and your particular familiarity with the EMA that they have been more willing to consider more innovative approaches in the rare disease area. That's been your experience too?
Yes, they were actually supportive in doing that. Of course, they want to know that type 1 error control in the confirmatory and study 3 or 2B23, that the type 1 error control is really done. They want to, this to be shown and proven. But other than that, it's not like, oh, we have never seen something like that, we don't do it. It's really, oh, this looks what a complex, please explain. So there's a positive attitude towards that, because everyone knows to bring these things fast to the market, if you're in a rare disease, you cannot really have a recruitment of too many people. So you have to make your decisions very carefully with getting all the information out of any patient that you can recruit into a clinical trial, because you don't have so many.
I was going to say, one of the advantages of an adaptive trial is that each subject, shall we say, has greater value.
I think the main advantage really is that you do not stick too long to a wrong decision.
Yeah.
So in the end, it's not really like if you would make with a non-adaptive approach only correct decisions, actually you would need less people. But because you have so many uncertainties in rare diseases, so one of your problems is not only that you have few people from which you can recruit to your clinical trial, no, but you also start with much less knowledge as compared to the non-rare diseases. So you do not really know what is the good endpoint that I should measure in the people that is sensitive to the changes. You do not really know what the effect size in this endpoint really is. You don't know much about its variability, and you may have subgroups in your rare disease even, which react better or worse to the treatment. And all these things you have much less knowledge on as compared to a non-rare disease. So if you would start with the same strategy, you would choose an endpoint, choose an effect size and a variability around that effect size in some group, and all of these things would be with a high uncertainty, and thus your whole planning may be completely wrong. And you cannot really afford going into a clinical trial pretending you would know a lot of things that you actually do not know. And thus, starting with plausible assumptions, but allowing the trial to adapt to the learning that you do with each new patient or in certain interim decision-making processes, to adapt to the continuous learning that you do along the trial, helps you prevent going for a long time in the wrong direction. And that would really be foolish, because in adaptive clinical trials for rare diseases, the slow recruitment is actually an advantage for the adaptivity. They are a very natural choice for a rare disease indication.
So Ursula, I was going to ask you, you've really covered the regulatory perspective, but from the sponsor's point of view and their stakeholders, what is it about an adaptive approach that holds promise?
Well, one thing that I would recommend everyone to look into is on the CITEL pages, there are the 10 steps for adaptive designs, the 10 steps that you should consider before you start going adaptive, which are from Jim Bolognese and a colleague, because they are very nice. And the very first question is whether or not the time between the interim observation for adaptation and the enrollment of the last patient, whether there's enough time between those. if you have a very fast recruitment, then and you need a long time, like a survival endpoint to observe the endpoint, then typically it wouldn't make much sense. It would only make sense to go adaptive if you would potentially have a early biomarker which you could use for interim decision making. Then it makes sense again. Going adaptive becomes advantageous beyond rare diseases in situations A, where you have this uncertainty on certain important decisions, like the population, like the endpoint, like the effect size and the variability in the endpoints. When you have a considerable amount of uncertainty in any of those, it makes a lot of sense to do a blinded sample size re-estimation or an interim decision, like in a group sequential design, where you just check your basic assumptions and you can go the one way or the other based on some interim analysis. It also helps sometimes for those smaller companies that have investors to convince the investors to spend some money on this first step, because they wouldn't have to spend all the money immediately without any intermediate confirmation that the investment is well. So it also helps spending money with less risk.
And Ursula, that sounds like that's a motif that connects the advantages from all the stakeholder point of views, is that an adaptive design, adaptive approach can help to accumulate knowledge that can be used for better decision making about the adaptation of the trial design itself.
Yes, and the less firm knowledge you have before you start with your trial, the more it becomes looking attractive.
Yeah, hence the well match, the good fit, if you will, between most rare disease development efforts and an adaptive approach, because so often in rare disease, as you said, you don't have the depth of historical knowledge, you don't have the depth of data from previous research that you might in other therapeutic areas. Is that a good way to characterize?
That's a very excellent way to characterize.
What advice, what would you say to sponsors in the rare disease area who are considering an adaptive approach, or what their best strategy is for development?
It's actually not that much different from the advice that I would give to any other drug development. It is always, first of all, look very closely into the data that you already have and make the best use of that. So also making a lot of use of the pharmacometric information that you may have and what you have learned from the animal studies to transport that into good decision-making already for the first other studies. So that's no different. Same actually for the adaptivity. No matter what you do, adaptivity is just one choice you have to make during your drug development, whether or not it makes sense for your specific drug development. Once you have decided that your trial or your drug development would be best supported with some adaptation in the trial, I think the main advice is really go into discussions with the authorities as soon as possible to make sure that what you have in mind is being supported by them.
Yeah. Always is. I was going to ask what types of questions, what are they looking for at the FDA in terms of validating or their acceptance of a more innovative trial design and approach?
Well, if your trial is designed to provide solid evidence for efficacy, so being a pivotal or a confirmatory trial, then the of utmost importance is that you show that you are that your type 1 error control is done in with the whole adaptivity, that the adaptivity does not lead to too many false positives outcomes of your trial. So that's a statistically, there is a lot of statistical methodology out, and all the adaptive steps are still done in a way that your type 1 error control is still solid. Then next to that, obviously, you need to do simulations to show that also the chances of success for your trial are in good shape, so that the power is good, so that you really get the most information out of and enough information out to make a solid decision also in the sense that if there is an effect, that you really have a chance to find it with the trial. That predominantly will be done with simulation.
And those simulations are validated with the your counterparts, the statistical peers at the FDA or the EMA?
They want to see the calculations and they will check on that. They want to see, and I think there is a sophisticated side of the authorities as well that can see whether or not these calculations are done in a solid way.
It sounds like you speak from experience.
I've just had a very nice discussion and defense of a very innovative trial design with the EMA September this year. And it was the sponsor with 5 persons and me and another consultant or 2 other consultants in one row, and on the other side it was about 40 people from various European countries and the EMA posing us a lot of questions, and they challenged each single step from the pharmacometric, from the pharmacology side, and then very many questions also regarding the complexity of the trial, because we have almost everything is adaptive in this trial. So we have a population enrichment, we have a sample size re-estimation, we have a dose selection. So there were a lot of steps, mm-hmm. and they really wanted to know that the planning was thorough and that we have thought of all aspects that need to be thought of to not only ensure the statistical properties, but also ensure that we don't introduce an operational bias into the whole process and that we do the right decision at the right time point.
Yeah, I think that illustrates how comprehensive the considerations need to be beyond just the statistical considerations with a trial, a more innovative trial, but also to think about what the implementation realities are going to be. So it sounds like you also have to be able to defend the operational and implementation characteristics of the trial, not just the statistical methodologies.
Yeah, I think what the authorities want to see is that you have been thinking of these operational aspects of running an adaptive trial, and they must get the impression that you know how to handle the blinding, how to ensure that there is no bias introduced by people inferring what has been seen in the interim decision-making process, and thus then doing their things differently in the next stage of the trial. And obviously, this requires a good data management, first of all, and firewalls between the people that are allowed to know everything and those people that shall remain blinded until the end of the trial.
Well, Ursula, this has been an interesting conversation for me to learn more about some of the challenges, particularly to rare disease development and how statistical innovations are making a difference and what lies in the near future for rare disease development using more innovative approaches. And we can learn more about your appearances and the contributions that you're making to the science by going to SciTel.com's events page. That's just SciTel.com/events. So that's one place that those listening can go to hear about your schedule and advances that are being made in better trials, better clinical results for all the stakeholders, the sponsors, investors, the scientists and engaged in the medical community, but maybe perhaps especially the patients themselves.
So thanks a lot, Mike.
And thank you, Ursula. Thanks for joining me.